Welcome to the Just Raise podcast. I'm your host, Joe Sweeney. On this show, we talk to early stage founders and investors, diving into product, business model, markets, and venture capital. I'm joined by expert guest hosts to cover sectors like fintech, direct-to-consumer, biotech, and the new space industry. Today on the show, we're talking to Vanessa Clark, CEO of Atomos. Atomos is building vehicles for a radical new use case in space, last-mile satellite transportation. Orbital transfer vehicles, nicknamed space tugs in the industry, will attach to satellites and ferry them to new orbits, a lot like tow trucks or tugboats here on Earth, but in space. They're also committed to making their vehicles nuclear-powered. This conversation gets a bit technical at points, so if you haven't been following our space series, I highly recommend checking out our episodes with companies like Rocket Labs or investors like Tess Hatch and Delian Asparuhov, who give the big picture of the space ecosystem and can put some context to what we talk about in this episode. I hope you enjoy this conversation on the future of the space industry with Vanessa. And as always, thanks for listening. Vanessa, it's fantastic to have you on the show, and I'm really excited to talk about Atomos and space tugs. So to start us off, what is Atomos? What are you building, and what are space tugs?
So Atomos is building and operating orbital transfer vehicles, or OTVs. These are space tugs, like you said. So they're satellites that can rendezvous with, capture, and move other satellites in space. There's a whole host of reasons why this is a great business model, and it enables a whole bunch of new businesses and also exploration missions in space. And it's really part of our mission as a company. So our goal is to reduce the cost of access to space and enable satellites to get to where they need to be. But we also have a long-term vision to realize breakthrough propulsion technologies. As a company, we want to make the solar system small.
Yeah, so maybe to start right there with the breakthrough propulsion technologies, I don't know a lot about satellite propulsion, but I know that none of them thus far are nuclear powered, and I think that's one of the things that Atomos is working on. What does your propulsion system look like?
So stepping back and talking about the two main parameters that make a good in-space propulsion system. So we have thrust, which makes us go fast, and something that we call specific impulse, which is essentially the same as gas mileage. So we can go further and we can actually go faster in some cases if we have good specific impulse. And having good specific impulse also makes the system a lot smaller. Historically, we've had to choose between either high thrust or high specific impulse. High thrust you can get from chemical systems, high specific impulse you can get from electric propulsion. So there's a whole bunch of satellites in space today that use electric propulsion. So they either use charged grids or charged anode and cathodes to accelerate a propellant. Our system combines the best of both worlds. So we use electric propulsion, so electric thrusters that generate a plasma from a propellant, accelerate it to high speeds with applied magnetic fields, which allows us to have really high ISP. But then our secret sauce is that we make these things supercharged. We have a lot of electrical power available to them by the use of a small modular reactor. And this allows us to have pretty high thrust. So we get the best of both worlds, so high thrust and high ISP, which allows for commercial missions, really rapid transfers in Earth orbit, or for deep space missions, we can do really interesting things like get cargo or crew from Earth to Mars in order of weeks instead of months, or the better part of a year. So it's really the pinnacle of what we should be doing to get around once we're in space.
So to break that down, and I'm a little out of my depth here, but it sounds like the ISP is something along the lines of like an ion engine, where you propel something very slowly, but over time in space, because there's no friction, the device you're pushing goes faster and faster and faster. Whereas high thrust is like a rocket where it's high thrust, you can move very fast, but you run out of rocket fuel pretty quick. Is that right?
Yes, exactly.
Gotcha. And you guys are working on modular nuclear reactors to instead fuel this and be able to do both, because nuclear can last forever, but also generate a high amount of electricity quickly for thrust.
So Atomos is a company We're focused on building the orbital transfer vehicles. So the nuclear power source is really just a bunch of things that we're developing. But I'd like to add the caveat that we are not a nuclear company. We're not developing our own nuclear fuels or nuclear moderators. We're configuring the system so it works for us. So you won't see us getting any licenses from the Department of Energy or the NRC to start building those nuclear fuels ourselves, but it's something that we use in our systems.
Maybe we could circle back on that to some of the more interesting micro-nuclear companies that you're interested in. But on the Atomos side, so on Space Tugs, the kind of obvious thing here is all of the micro-satellite companies that are sending up constellations and really need to get their satellites into the right orbit. And that's what these orbital tugs do, as I understand it. And there's a lot of demand for those. There are over 100 different micro-satellite constellation companies now, and more getting funded all the time. And there's demand for launch, but also being in the right orbit is a differentiator. Can you talk a little bit about how, first of all, how you actually get off a rocket and into orbit, and then how your whole system would work in orbit?
Yeah, so one of the advantages of orbital transfer vehicles is you only need to launch them once. So in a typical launch where the majority of the propulsion is done by a system on board the satellite, you lose mass and volume that could have otherwise been used for payload. That stuff is already in space on the orbital transfer vehicle. So once our systems are up and operating, they wait in quiescence in a staging orbit. When a client satellite launches, the client satellite can go on a rideshare rocket like SpaceX's Transporter missions. One was meant to launch today, but I've heard that it's been delayed to tomorrow. They can really reduce the mass and cost that they launch with that satellite, since they don't need a big onboard propulsion system to get to their final destination. So once the satellite's launched and put into its insertion orbit, our systems rendezvous with and capture the client satellite, transfer it to the final destination, precision deploy it where it needs to be. And in the case of microsat constellations, we can deploy many satellites at once in different planes or different phases, so spaced out all over the globe as they're needed. And then our orbital transfer vehicle returns to a staging orbit for refueling or for another mission.
That's amazing. They're tow trucks in orbit. We're jumping around a little bit here, but one thing that I would love to talk to you about is how you got started with Atomos. So I know you're an aerospace engineer by trade, but what was the story behind how you actually got started with this company?
Before I moved to the US, I worked in launch vehicle design. So in launch vehicle upstage design, and then I was part of DLR, so the German Aerospace Center's launch vehicle design group. And try to find our mission as an academic research group was very difficult, but we defined it as determining what investments Europe should make in the launch sector. And so we really had a bird's eye view of the industry. And one of the challenges we're trying to address was, what should we build next? What comes after the Ariane and Vega fleet of rockets? What is the market demanding? And how do we reduce costs to compete with, back then, this is nearly 10 years ago, the up-and-coming SpaceX. And one optimal solution is orbital transfer vehicles, so breaking launch into two segments. So taking heavy payloads to low orbits, inserting them there, and then completing in-space transportation using a different method. Breaking into two segments, we can talk about the physics as to why it's optimal. But while we're in the agency, there really wasn't that much uptake. You know, the aerospace industry is really conservative and slow-moving. And so having like a technical and business solution that made a lot of sense, but not having leadership willingness to invest in that was really the motivation for moving to the US and starting Atomos. After I moved to the US, I did work for a couple of years in industry at Lockheed. So I was primarily a propulsion engineer. So I became a principal engineer in propulsion and then also a program manager, mostly on civil space missions, so spacecraft that we're building for Lockheed. I did that mostly to get my footing, learn the industry, and also really learn everything that wasn't advanced concepts. I was used to, from my previous experience, doing paper studies, advanced concepts, optimization and sizing, but I had never actually seen flight hardware be built or operated. So I got experience in everything I hadn't done before stepping out to start Atomos with my co-founder, William, who I was introduced to actually start the company in 2017.
You got some hands-on experience with the actual machinery on the ground. I think that's a great segue into how you're actually going to be building these vehicles. So one of the truly amazing things about Atomos is these have never been built before. People have made satellites, people have made rockets, people have made microsats, but there aren't any vehicles that are designed to sit in orbit and then drive around and pick up satellites. I mean, even attaching to different satellites, they don't come in a standard size. And then there's all types of questions around if you're doing that, then you can do satellite life extension and fix them and things like that. But how is that design working and how are you actually building it on the ground? Are you outsourcing a lot of it?
That's a really great question. And it's something that is really inherent to our strategy. So for us, if it's been done before, if it's something that can be bought off the shelf and something that we're not going to iterate and improve on, then we are buying it from vendors. And we're investing all of our time and effort into things that are new and novel, such as refueling, docking, what we call ubiquitous autonomous rendezvous. There are so many new elements that we're focused on, but anything that's similar to a spacecraft program that's been built before, we're just buying where possible, trying to make smart investments. And so we're definitely not fully integrated like SpaceX is, but we completely own all of the novel aspects, including some of the areas that you touched on. You seem to be very well attuned with the challenges that we're going to face as we start bringing these systems into operation.
I mean, I picked up a few things by getting to talk to some of the other guests on the show. But yeah, so one of the things I actually hear from guests all the time is that the space industry supply chain is just very subscale. So I'm curious what of the base of your vehicle is going to be. Do you have an off-the-shelf satellite that you like for it or that you've been able to find, or are you really going to have to build a lot of that?
The system itself is completely custom, but certain components are pretty standard. I mean, reaction wheels and star trackers and radios, like they're things we don't need to innovate, but we do have to integrate the system ourselves because the way we're combining those components is very novel. And I also have to say one of the challenges is that in a lot of cases, these components have only been built for NASA or Department of Defense programs and not for commercial programs. So there've been cases where we've gone to talk to vendors about a component and it's been a couple of orders of magnitude more expensive than what we think it should be. And so we're actually flying some non-space components for our specific applications if we can't build it in-house. So it's been, a journey in putting these unconventional systems together.
That's one of the things you hear with SpaceX too, is they initially planned to, I think, just develop the human capsule, and then they went to go buy rockets, and you just can't because everything's 100 times more expensive than you'd think it'd be because they're selling to the U.S. government. So some of the use cases that you mentioned are fascinating, things like resupply and docking. How do you think about that when you go up into low Earth orbit? Like you were saying, everything is custom built for yourself. Everything is custom built for everyone. There are no off-the-shelf satellites and every satellite is different. So how do you think about docking with a satellite? How would that even work?
So when we first started looking at this problem, we drew up a list of all the commonalities between satellites in terms of mechanical interfaces and in terms of operations. So our systems are compatible with the vast majority of unmodified, unprepared satellites. So from an operations perspective, to be able to rendezvous with a satellite, all we have to do is ask that satellite to hold still. And we design the entire concept of operations based on how satellites operate today. So satellites in low Earth orbit have periods where they're in eclipse and where they're in sunlight. So they have different modes and different durations where they can do a certain operation. We designed rendezvous to fit within one of those modes or windows. So they don't really have to do anything new or different. In fact, in a lot of cases, our client satellites don't even need new flight software. Now on the mechanical side of things, there are a few really common components that satellites share. And one of the primary components is how it attaches to the launch vehicle. So we actually connect to satellites with their launch vehicle adapter interface. And so this is residual interface for how they were initially clamped to the launch vehicle. There are some satellites that are a little bit too small that don't have this interface and we can't rendezvous with them with our first couple of generations of systems. But we can cover the vast majority of the environment of the satellites already in space. This is also an approach taken by a couple of companies such as Northrop Grumman. So they have a system that's operating today that's leveraging components already on board the spacecraft. And, you know, we're taking a similar approach, but we're targeting different elements of the spacecraft.
Yeah, so that's fascinating. So you use the kind of standard model of how they attach to the rocket to then reattach to your vehicle. And is this like a giant robotic arm that goes and like grabs a satellite and then pulls it to wherever it needs to be? What does that attaching look like?
So we're getting to the point where I might have to stop talking. But we do have a really unique robotic solution. So there are, we're not using one robotic arm, is as much as I would say. But, you know, the challenge for us was finding something that was low cost and also lightweight, as well as being really capable. And so I think we've actually found a design solution that has all of those and ticks all of the boxes, but it's not a single arm.
That's really cool. Well, just on the manufacturing and product side, how far along are you guys in development? And then when do you plan to launch?
Yeah, so we're currently anticipating the launch of our first system in the second half of 2022. So we've completed a lot of the key development testing. So the first vehicle has two types of brand new thrusters that use our low-cost propellant. We've done one development campaign of those. We have further development and qualification and integrated systems testing of that to do for the rest of 2021. But the big thing that we've focused a lot of our effort on is Rendezvous. So Rendezvous sensors, software, sensor integration, concept of operations. So that's something that our team has really been focused on for the past year. And while the first mission is primarily a demonstration mission, we actually have the opportunity to move paying customers around. So we'll actually be looking to get revenue from this first mission as well.
When you're developing a new spacecraft like this, it sounds like a lot of it is testing the thrusters, and then you're focused on Rendezvous, so attaching to the actual devices. What else are kind of the key pieces of the pipeline, like milestones that you have to cross to get this to the point where you're confident putting it on a rocket and sending it into orbit?
One of the key things that we're doing is hardware in the loop ground testing. So setting up really an avionics test bed that allows us to have an emulator of a client satellite, putting really part of our avionics system and our entire Rendezvous suite in front of it and on a essentially movable bed that is driven by our flight simulator, and seeing if our quasi spacecraft operates the way that we're anticipating. And so this really big hardware in the loop test campaign is our big milestone for 2021, because it'll prove that we've selected the right sensors. All of our image processing and machine vision is correct. Our Rendezvous algorithms are correct and have been refined and tweaked. And then everything works coherently. Spacecraft are really interesting machines. I mean, they're computers with not that much computing power, with not that much electrical power. And so you're always on a knife edge between having a nominal operation and completely losing power or control of the system. So making sure that there's no edge case or boundary case or transition where we could be in a mode where we do lose the spacecraft or do something terrible like collide into the client satellite. That's the big campaign we're doing this year and our biggest milestone before the launch.
Yeah, those seem like very key things to be aware of. Your team must be pretty interesting because you have aerospace engineers, of course, who are building this spacecraft, but also software. In a lot of ways, this is like building an autonomous vehicle, except you don't have to be on the road. You're flying through space. What does that look like? Do you have a large engineering team as well?
Yes, I have to say that as a propulsion engineer, I've learned way more about software than I ever thought I would. So currently we're a team of 19. And flight software and guidance and navigation is our largest group. And I'm really grateful that we have a really, really strong Rendezvous lead who's able to do translation for us and lead the software and GNC team, but then also disseminate key data and use terms that the executives understand. And I think one really important thing has been finding people who have the applicable experience, because I mean, Rendezvous missions have been done before. We're trying not to reinvent the wheel. We're just trying to make smart changes that make it much more cost-effective, much more safe, more autonomous, more scalable. And so our Rendezvous lead does have experience in multiple Rendezvous missions before joining us at Atomos.
I always find it amazing that startup founders in the space can find someone where it's like, yeah, we have to build a brand new reentry vehicle. So we found like the person who built the only other two reentry vehicles. And it's amazing how you managed to do that.
Yeah, ultimately, the right type of people just want to work on cool things.
Yeah. That seems to be pretty common in the space industry. So this feels a lot like a small airline or Uber, in that you'll have economies of scale once you can get a few in orbit. But I'm curious what you project in terms of costs and then also price to be able to do this.
Yeah. So the answer is always, it depends. Just like an Uber or Lyft ride. It depends. It depends on whether you can ride share with someone else. It depends how fast you want to go, because we can burn more propellant to get you to your destination faster. It also depends on the total delta V, or really how far you want to go in space. Because if it's a big delta V mission, then we have a long way to come back to our staging orbit. But currently, our pricing is set that it reduces the cost of putting a satellite to its target orbit by 20 to 40% over today's costs. But today's cost also includes things like onboard propulsion system and the cost to launch that propellant onboard your own satellite. And in some cases, it also includes the cost that is a penalty for not being able to rideshare. And so we've designed our systems to ensure that we always provide value, but we're benchmarking, having cost savings across the board.
Yeah. When you say delta V mission, do you mean change in velocity, acceleration, or just distance?
Yeah. So it's really difficult to talk about orbital mechanics on a podcast without any diagrams. But to change your orbits, you need to speed up or slow down. Your lower orbits, you have a faster orbital velocity. As you go to higher orbits, you're actually going slower. So it's really weird to think that once you're in space, if you slow down, you actually go to higher orbit. It's really counterintuitive. And so delta V is a good catch-all metric for showing that change in velocity to change orbits, either changing altitude or doing things like changing inclination. So for example, SpaceX Transporter, so the launch that was meant to launch today, goes to a sun synchronous or polar orbit. So when it launches, it flies over the North and South Pole. You may want to change inclination. So instead you're more where the ISS is, in a mid-inclination orbit. So you may orbit, you know, peak in Northern Europe, and then the bottom of that orbit may be tip of Tasmania in Australia. So we can do that inclination change as well, which also takes delta V. Another maneuver that takes delta V that we talk about is phasing. So think about Starlink and how that system's being launched and how it has persistent ground coverage. In a single orbital plane, so satellites that have the same inclination and the same altitude, you have multiple satellites in that plane and they're spaced around in a ring. So the spacing between those satellites is called the phasing. And to change phasing, you also need delta V. And so an orbital transfer vehicle providing delta V can do all of those things. So altitude changes and inclination changes and phasing.
And this is why you need high thrust, I imagine, to be able to accelerate delta V in different directions.
So you can do it with low thrust. It just takes a really long time. So one really good mission example is getting a geostationary telecommunication satellite to its operational orbit in GEO. So GEO is at around 37,000 kilometers in altitude, but it's very rare for a satellite to be inserted there directly by a launch vehicle because it's just so far away. So a satellite's typically put into an interim orbit that we call GTO, or geostationary transfer orbit. If that satellite has onboard propulsion, they really have two choices, chemical or electric. If they use a chemical engine, they can do that orbit raise in 3-4 weeks, doing a discrete burn every time they orbit the Earth. If they use electric propulsion, they can thrust constantly to do that orbit raise, but it can take 6 to 9 months because they just don't have much thrust. So you can still do maneuvers like this with electric propulsion. It just takes a long time.
Gotcha.
Which is where we come in with our higher thrust systems.
Yeah. And the difference between GEO and LEO, for anyone who's listening, GEO is geostationary orbit, like what you said, was much further away because it's higher above the Earth. And LEO is low Earth orbit, so lower. The other thing I want to ask you about is demand. And we were talking about how there are a ton of CubeSat companies and things like that. And as more satellites go up with slightly different hardware and different sensors that differentiate them, the other key is where in orbit they are. So if you're in orbit over the equator, it's very different than being in orbit over the North Pole or being in orbit on the dark side of the Earth. How you think about demand and what that will look like and who your early clients would be?
Yeah, so that's a really great question. So first, I want to make the point that the market is likely very elastic. So having been in early spacecraft design myself, some of the key questions you ask before designing a constellation is, how much is it going to cost to get there? How much is it going to cost to stay there? So orbital maintenance. And do we have to remove ourselves and deorbit our system at the end of life? And so cost, launch, onboard propulsion needs really dictate what orbit is optimal for a constellation. Talking to some constellation providers, they'd actually like to be higher up, but the business case didn't close, particularly if you want to do things like deorbit and dispose of your satellite at the end of life. The higher up you are, the more costly that is to do. So if we reduce the costs to higher orbits, we could anticipate that in the future, those markets in higher orbits would open up. Now, in terms of our first customers, so we really have a couple of really interesting first segments. You did mention before microsat operators and nanosat operators in low Earth orbit. So these are companies that are doing Earth observation with very small satellites or providing data such as Internet of Things connectivity. These are really great first customers because often they need to precision place their satellites. They get lower launch costs if they rideshare with a SpaceX mission, for example, or as a secondary payload on another launch vehicle. But then how do they get from their insertion orbit to their operational orbit, which is where we come in? And so they're a really big first market segment that we're looking at. On the other hand, our orbital transfer vehicles can also rendezvous, capture, and maneuver satellites that are already in space. We don't need to meet satellites in a low orbit. We can rendezvous with them in their current operational orbit. So relocation and disposal of satellites is also a really big mission segment that we're looking into as well. There's a customer base where they want to relocate their satellites for new missions or move satellites out of a particular orbital slot to free up that slot for other purposes, and also saving onboard propellant. So one interesting case, again, in geostationary Earth orbit. So these large satellites typically conserve 6 months of orbital maintenance propellant for their end-of-life disposal mission. They have to get out of geostationary Earth orbit once they stop operating, because geostationary Earth orbit, the slots where you put satellites, is actually tightly controlled. It's very valuable real estate. So they want to get out of that orbit at the end of the satellite's life. But doing that cuts the satellite's lifetime short by 6 to 12 months, which reduces the revenue of the system by tens of millions of dollars. So we're also offering a service where we can do that maneuvering for them with our own orbital transfer vehicles, meaning they can operate their systems for 6 to 12 months longer and recoup that additional revenue. So there's a whole bunch of really interesting mission cases that's not just initial deployment of satellites, but also moving them once they're up there.
What are you most interested in terms of some of the stuff that's happening in space right now? There are a lot of really interesting companies being built. And in a lot of ways, it feels like a small emerging economy that's getting built. And I'm curious, beyond Atomos, which is very much like this next generation use case of things that have never been done, what else are you interested in?
Ooh, that's a good question. I'm trying to think of some of my favorite customers. So from the commercial side of things, broadband internet constellations are really interesting. So I've been living internationally abroad in Germany and the US for over a decade, but it's only been the past couple of years where I could actually do video calls with my family back in Australia because they just didn't have adequate internet. So seeing the change that suddenly having good connectivity brings is really inspiring. And so I do like these broadband constellation companies. So I mean, SpaceX is one, but there's Amazon Kuiper and OneWeb, and then a few that are also attempting to connect directly to cell phones over 5G. Like this is all really, really interesting stuff that I hope they're successful in. And I think it's something that's really going to be most impactful here on Earth as well.
Yeah, all really amazing use cases. But the other thing that we were talking about is that at some point you aim for your propulsion system to be electric, but also powered by a nuclear reactor. And you've had some success in driving policy on that front too, and lobbying the US government for changes. What innovation has happened thus far? Because nuclear, I mean, as I understand it, we haven't built that many nuclear power plants in the last 50 years, and fusion is still a ways out, but it seems to be a rising industry.
Yeah, so let's see, my interest in nuclear came about even before I got into aerospace. I actually studied nuclear physics in my undergrad and I worked at a research reactor. Part of the motivation for starting Atomos was that all of the barriers to realizing this technology were not related to safety or technology. It was all due to investment and policy. And so that was, as you mentioned, like a really big area that we focused on when we first started the company. Now that, let's say, there's more favorable winds for the nuclear industry, so a lot of environmentalists and climate change activists are realizing that nuclear has to be part of the solution if we're going to limit the effects of climate change. So there has been a lot more investment in terrestrial nuclear systems, but also with the additional investment, there have been some policy updates, not just on the space nuclear side, but also on terrestrial nuclear. And so some of the companies that I'm really excited about on the terrestrial nuclear side of things includes Oklo. So they're a Y Combinator company, really great young founding team. And they're one of the furthest ahead through the regulatory approval processes. So, you know, they're blowing by some of the heritage folks who were previously at larger nuclear companies like Westinghouse. And so it's exciting to see a nuclear company that can move that quickly.
Yeah, I've seen a bunch of startups in the space. I haven't gotten to talk to any yet, but it's on my list of things to do for sure. And the other major thing that I want to ask you about is about your fundraising. So fundraising for Atomos has been a little different in that you have raised a lot of capital through the U.S. government and specifically the AFWERX program, which is, as I understand it, a really interesting program out of the Air Force where they aim to give grants to startup companies and just deploy DoD dollars to early stage companies. So I'm curious what your experience working with AFWERX has been like and how that has evolved to be able to provide you funding to start the company.
So we love AFWERX, but one correction, you said they're grants. They're not grants, they're contracts. So we do have stuff that we have to deliver. It's not just a, here is some money, go off and improve the world. It's like, no, go find end users, find their specific needs and build what they need for them. I think that it's really been a phenomenal process because they, firstly, rather than soliciting solutions to discrete problems that they have, they're like, you know what? People who best know the solutions and the problems that we probably have aren't us in the contracting or acquisition offices. It's probably commercial industry. And so they completely flipped the process and they were like, hey, come to us with a proposal for a way that you can help us come with end users in the Department of Defense or the US government. And if there's match, we will fund you to develop the thing for your Department of Defense or US government end user. And so this is not only a lot more agile, it's not only a lot more valuable in terms of not wasting R&D dollars, it's also really valuable in bringing innovation, because a lot of the best ideas come from industry and not from the actual customer or the acquisition offices. So it's been really great. Unfortunately, I can't tell you that much more about our AFWERX contract because we're not allowed to talk about it.
Gotcha. Can you tell us about how AFWERX is broken down? So I think they start with like 150K contracts and then work up to 1.5, 2 million, which is I think where you guys are at now.
It's actually a little bit different. So the phase one contracts are $50,000 over 3 months. And the goal of the phase one is to get an end user or a customer in the government to sign a memorandum of understanding that they want your solution. So it's all business development. So the US government is paying us to go do business development with them to work out what they want, which is great because, I mean, it's a little bit of cash for us, but it really makes this a priority to go talk to the right people and find end users who can use our products. So that's phase one. If you do get the MOU with some additional letters of support from the government, you can go to a phase two. So for us, because it was in the middle of the pandemic, we actually had a larger phase two. So it was a $1.5 million contract, but the typical phase two size is 750K.
Moving forward, are you planning on bringing on substantial venture dollars to fuel manufacturing and then also launch and things like that?
Yeah. So being a hardware company is capital intensive. We have closed a Series A raise recently, but we will be doing future fundraisers to extend the fleet and to develop new vehicles and capabilities. But the US government's also been a really great source of development dollars for us. So they're not just a customer, they're also providing non-dilutive capital to help development of our systems.
That's fantastic. Is that Series A public? I may have missed it in my research.
Well, it is now.
Well, congratulations.
Thank you.
Well, my last question always on the show is about your vision for the company long term. And where do you see Atomos in the next 10, 20 years?
So being a transportation company, we're really going to be the FedEx of space. I hate to use an analogy like that, but we shouldn't be designing satellites being constrained by what launch vehicle they go on, or limiting the mission lifetime or operating orbit by what we think we can buy in terms of a propulsion system. We want to completely decouple satellite design and utility and space missions and businesses from launch and propulsion. Right now, they're so integral. And when you start designing a mission and a constellation, you pick the launch vehicle and propulsion system, which limits ultimately the flexibility and utility of the system. So we want to be the company that allows those two to be completely separate. And then also, since we're talking long-term vision, like in 20 years, when we're going to be shipping packages to the moon, Mars, asteroid belt, like this is what our propulsion systems can do really, really well.
That's amazing. So you eventually imagine a world where satellites won't need propulsion systems at all, which will make them lighter and completely enabled by Atomos.
Yes, but with one small caveat, have to be aware of space debris. So satellites should have onboard propulsion systems for orbital maintenance and collision avoidance. Like sending up a brick to space is dangerous. So please, please have a little bit of maneuverability, but it can be a very, very low cost small system where Atomos does the rest.
That is one thing that I don't think we've talked about on the show at all and seems to be pretty polarizing. You either care a lot about space debris or not at all about space debris. What is space debris and like, should we be worried about it?
Oh yeah. So let's say that it's the early days of awareness and action for space debris, but it's still a tragedy at the commons. So with orbital velocities being so high, your system's traveling much, much faster than a bullet in opposite directions. If you have a collision even between two small satellites or even like a fragment of a satellite, you can have a really large explosive event, which creates more debris. And so if you've seen the movie Gravity, there are some things in that movie that really aren't interesting, but you can have this cascading chain reaction where you do have more debris generated, and we can actually lose orbital environments, and we could lose orbits in space as places that we can access, place satellites, do human space operations if we don't address space debris. From a business perspective, it's also really high risk. There are some insurance companies that have said that they're no longer going to insure operations in low Earth orbit because of the large orbital environment and space debris. And so it's something that we're going to eventually have to start addressing through active solutions, such as removing debris objects, but also through mitigating solutions. So making sure that satellites are removed at the end of their life and not causing debris. We also have some really great incentives and ideas for future policies. One thing that we plan on advocating for is ensuring that launch vehicle upper stages are not put into high or energetic orbits, or orbits that cross highly populated orbits. So if a launch vehicle has to terminate in a low orbit for debris mitigation purposes, then an orbital transfer vehicle is needed to distribute those satellites to its final destination. So this is something that we'd see would only happen after our business model has been demonstrated, and there's probably a diverse market providing the same services. But this type of thing that allows for passive debris mitigation is something that we really need to start doing in the next 20 years, or we're going to see some really, really big space environmental impacts.
It's so wild. So the idea there is essentially a satellite gets blown up, like China recently showed their ability to destroy satellites in orbit, or for some reason it breaks up. And then you have pieces flying through space at like hundreds or thousands of miles an hour. And if they collide with another satellite, that one blows up, which creates more. You can get to the point where you can't put anything in that orbit because it's a field of like flying metal and bullets.
Yeah. It's also really, really difficult because we can't track so much debris. There's actually a really great company called Leo Labs that's building ground-based radar stations to better characterize space debris, as well as be able to track satellites more accurately. But there are a lot of debris objects that are really dangerous that we think they're there from a statistics perspective, but we can't actually track it on radar or any other images. So a lot of cases, satellites are designed using probabilistic models for debris, saying like, oh, we think there could be this population of debris in the orbit that we're going to or moving through. So we need to add this extra shielding or titanium around our satellite in case it hits us. You know, it's really an uncertain form of engineering. And it's really terrifying that we can't track some of these really dangerous objects. And I mean, there are hundreds and thousands of them and millions of them that could take out a satellite that we just don't know the exact location of.
Yeah. And when you say stuff you can't track, I imagine something the size of like a screw that's flying through space that could take out the satellite that you just spent millions of dollars building.
You know, we could actually track that, but a flake of paint, a couple of millimeters going a lot faster than a bullet is also really dangerous and impossible to track. A liquid metal droplet of if a coolant hose was severed and some of the coolant got into space, those individual droplets going at that speed are still dangerous to a satellite. Like, not screw level, a fraction of that is still dangerous. And there's millions of those pieces that we just can't track.
Wow. What a scary concept. Well, that's a very scary, great note to end on. But Vanessa, I really appreciate you coming on the show. This has been fascinating. I've learned a ton that I did not know before. So I really appreciate it.
Yeah, it was a lot of fun. Thank you so much, Joe.
Yeah, and good luck with the Atomos. Looking forward to hearing about the round at some point soon.